Once more under the breach, dear friend.
Else close the wall up with our English dead.
And here we are, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, with another exciting episode of The Personal Wealth Coach, starring Jeff and
Jake
McClure. And at this point, I'm supposed to do a disclosure, so stand by for a disclosure. The Personal Wealth Coach is not only a riveting, exciting radio program
that's under some circumstances.
Under some circumstances, and that is our opinion.
Right.
It's exciting because we could really screw up sometime during the next 2 hours. It is also the name of a SEC registered investment advisory firm in Salado, Texas, that manages money in investments for people on a fee only basis. So just thought you'd know that. And anything that we say on here should not be considered to be investment advice. It is instead education. And we have obtained the information that we disclose and use on this program from sources we believe to be reliable, but we don't warranty these facts, the statements that we make, as being absolutely true under all circumstances. I mean, we
hope they are.
We use the news releases that are available to everybody, and that's what we work with.
Fake news.
Yeah, and the telephone number in here is 773-1400. Of course, the area code is 254 and then 773-1400 if you'd like to join with us, presuming, now that's with the assumption that today is the last day of the third quarter of the 21st of 2017 in the 21st century, which means like September 30th. And if it's any other day, then you can call all you want to, but we won't answer.
You said it was under the presumption and assumption.
Mm-hmm, both.
Both of them?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's getting technical.
We pre-assumed
and we presumed.
Did all that stuff.
Right. Okay. So, what's happened this week? You got back from vacation.
I got back from vacation and the world continued to turn.
Even while you were gone, the world continued to turn. It's amazing.
The Dow Jones Industrial Average was up quarter of a percent. The S&P 500 was up 0.68, which is not all that significant, except that the S&P 500 was up like 4% for the third quarter, and the average in the third quarter over history is a negative number. More importantly, the average for the month of September, during which it was up very nicely as well, is also a negative number through history. So we've had a really, really good quarter. Year to date, the S&P 500 is up 12.53%. From a year ago, it's up over 16%. I mean,
that's all good news.
It's all good news. And there's a lot of talk about the market being overpriced. It's not. The reason the stock market is up is a very legitimate reason. Corporate earnings are up. And we had an unusual time in 2015, in first part of 2016, in that corporate profits went through a recession, but the rest of the country didn't. And there's been a lot of discussion among economists and so on as to why corporations found themselves less than profitable during that period of time. And it's almost all to do with the price of oil going up to stratospheric levels and then falling down to abysmal levels.
Right. So when oil prices fell and everybody was saying, oh, what's that going to do to the economy? What a horrible thing. Well, this is the result.
Mm-hmm. And
we get to run more efficiently for less money.
The economy is just humming along very nicely. It's not knocking the ball out of the park, but that
second quarter GDP was just revised upward to 3.1%.
Yeah. From 3%?
Yeah, 3% numbers are things that we haven't seen for a while. And to have two in a row that are above 3%, it's pretty good news. It's a good symptom that the economy is doing well.
It's not going to do that well probably in this quarter because we had a couple of hurricanes.
Couple times two. There's four hurricanes hit.
But a couple, which is...
A couple.
Yeah, several hurricanes hit, and that will reflect in the GDP for the third quarter when it finally comes out.
And probably part of the fourth quarter too. But we may also get the rebuild effort, which is going to be a magnification on growth. So we'll have a ding for the fourth quarter, but not as big as a ding for the third quarter.
So it's kind of like a magnificent magnification.
Yes. Magnificent.
So we anticipate that both corporate profitability and the GDP will probably be up in the not too distant future. It's going to be down in the near future. You know, it is the only thing that's scary about this economy is it's running too smoothly.
There are some other scarinesses out there.
Yeah.
Not in the economy, but in the interest rate realm. If we do suddenly see an interest rate bump up, then we'll see bond prices drop. And the amount of money going into bonds is just getting bigger and bigger. It's like people, it's so normal for a bubble to exist and cause more people to want to get in. And there, I would say at this point, there's a bubble in the bond market. It's not just a froth anymore. I would say the bond market is well overpriced. And that's something that there are parts of the bond market that are not. The shorter term bonds are not overpriced. There are some areas of municipal bonds that aren't overpriced, though there's a greater risk there. But I would say bond market's in trouble. At some point in the next few years, we're going to see some blood in the water there. But you're right about the absolutely right about the rest of the economy. I don't see anything scary about the rest of it except for that.
Well, I suppose that's good. What else happened?
Let's see. Shall I jump into that story that I wanted to talk
about? Yeah, why don't you just go ahead. I mean,
two big events happened this week that lead to the following story. AIG was declared no longer too big to fail. If it failed right now, it would still take down a lot of companies. Just know that. But it was declared that. This is kind of a vestige, a leftover from the Great Recession. One of the leading causes of the recession was the way that AIG was doing. But not just AIG. There was a settlement this week between Citigroup and Lehman Brothers. Lehman Brothers is a dead company. It's literally with the estate of Lehman Brothers as if it's passed away, because it kind of has. But before I get into that, I'm going to go back in time. Do we have some harp music or something we could play at this point? Going back in time to the late 1930s and the invasion of China by Japan. It's not the first time they've done it, but then again, the Chinese have a long history of invading Japan as well. So this is pre-World War II, the beginnings of World War II. And I'm going to give a kind of a picture of what's going on in China now. Now, bear with me. It's not pure history just for the sake of history. It's to show you how history is rhyming again in the present. In China, there was a pretty big civil war going on. Been going on for quite a bit, and the Japanese were participating sporadically in it. The official invasion of China from Japan took place well after Japan had been in China for quite some time and participating in the Civil War. They just had been doing it in support of different factions in that Civil War. So there's a lot of chaos. There's also a lot of trade. The British were the prime movers in the world at the time. They were almost the sole superpower. The Japanese Navy was growing. They were getting more trade. The United States had a lot of trade, but it wasn't anything like what was going on in Britain. Well, the Japanese being involved in the Civil War in China caused the Western nations, most of Europe and the United States, to be slightly upset, more than slightly, but miffed a bit politically with Japan, and to begin starting some minor tariffs that would later culminate with some major tariffs, which would lead to the Japanese saying we were at war and bombing Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. So prior to that, one of the reasons why the tariffs went into place is when the Japanese invaded Shanghai, there were a lot of Westerners there. There were a lot of people that weren't involved in the Civil War, at least not directly, though they'd been funding it. The Western banks were present. There were American banks and British banks and Swiss banks and Dutch banks, and they were all on this downtown area of Shanghai. And there was no common currency at the time in China. There was a lot of trade with China. The tea industry was huge. It was still the biggest place for tea in the world. And the British really loved tea, and they were stretched all over the world, and so did a lot of other places. So tea and sugar and a lot of other agricultural products were being taken out of China. And quite often, the ships that would come to pick up the tea wouldn't be carrying gold. They would have a letter of credit on the bank of their choice back home. So then they would show up in Shanghai, which was one of the major hubs, the port areas, and they would load up on whatever agricultural product they wanted, tea, sugar, whatever it was, mostly tea. They would take the letter of credit to the bank, and the bank had a little, well, not little, it was a pretty nice branch in Shanghai. So the most of downtown Shanghai was Western banks. But because there wasn't a common currency, how do you buy tea from the locals? They're the ones that are coming to sell it to you. Each of the banks issued their own currency. This is kind of a strange situation, and they called it issuing paper. It's very much a letter of credit. It's just, hey, you deliver this to us, and we will give you that much value. The locals in China would use that paper to buy and sell things. The banks had a deal with each other that if you showed up another bank, so that, for instance, these aren't the banks of the time, but if we were talking about today's bank, Citigroup and Bank of America, would accept each other's paper. So if you try to pay a bill at Bank of America with some Citigroup paper, and again, these aren't the same banks, but you'll get the idea. Bank of America would honor it, but then they could turn and go back to the bank whose paper they had and give it to the bank, and their agreement was that they would give gold for that paper. So actual physical money at the time. So the Japanese are coming. They don't much care for Westerners or anybody else. They wanted their own sphere of influence, and they didn't want anybody else involved. They thought that the Japanese influence should be the only influence in the Pacific. So they start the invasion, an official invasion. And the embassies of all of the European nations and of the United States said, hey, it's time to go. Well, each of these banks secretly, not talking to the other banks, but it's funny because all of them were doing it, were collecting the paper of the other banks. None of the banks were in the lead. None of them were bigger drastically than the others. Some were slightly bigger, but they were all basically the same size. And they began collecting the paper of the other banks. And they would try to knock the other banks off by loading up a big crate full of the paper money issued by that bank and sending it all over at once to try to grab as much of the gold from the coffers as they could. And if the bank ran out of gold, then they had to close their doors. So all the trade would come to the bank that put them out of business. So it was a very much a dog-eat-dog, cutthroat world. There were no banking regulators present. It was still technically under the government of China, but nobody knew what that was. So this was a bank government. It was a bunch of warring bankers. And the day of the invasion of Shanghai, without coordinating this with each other, all of the banks tried to collect the gold from all of the other banks at the same time. It was a very exciting event. The crates were being carried on poles through the streets of Shanghai, running back and forth when everybody was supposed to be evacuating. Now, here's a problem. When the evacuation order came, most of the gold had already been evacuated. So this agreement where you show up with the paper and I give you the gold was still in effect, and all of the banks were trying to use this loophole to knock each other off. But all of them were doing it, and all of them had roughly the same amount of paper on each other. So if you just imagine dominoes in a circle, so tightly packed together in a circle that if you knock one down, none of them fall. They just lean on each other. Or a better analogy is a bunch of very well-dressed, drunk old men with monocles leaning on each other. Only in this case, they weren't doing it intentionally. They were pushing each other trying to knock the one in front of them down, and the one in front of them was trying to push the other one down. And so this big circle, none of them fell down. But it gives you a really good picture of banks don't like each other very much. In a non-regulated environment, they're constantly trying to put each other out of business. It's normal competition in like the car business or somewhere else. We don't think of that way in the banking world because there are regulations on this sort of thing. The people that get hurt when a bank goes down are the depositors. The bank gets hurt too.
Actually, if they're properly insured, the depositors don't get hurt. It's the shareholders that get hurt.
Right. And in this case, insurance was lacking. And the few insurance companies that were involved were insuring everyone. So if they'd all gone down, none of the insurance would have been available because they wouldn't have enough to cover all of the failures at the same time. As luck would have it, or human nature, all of this backstabbing happened at once and none of the banks failed because they were shuffling around the same gold to each other. They would hand each other paper for gold and then hand it right back for the paper. So this became a tenet of the banking finance regulatory concept of as long as one bank isn't tremendously larger than the others, if they all go through a disaster at the same time, they'll just lean on each other and nobody will fall down, which is a great reason why they don't even have to stand on their own. Just drink some more alcohol and leaning on each other in camaraderie or fake camaraderie, trying to knock each other down. So just keep that image of the drunkards all lined up in a circle. Coming forward, because this actually has a reason. Coming forward, we don't see that kind of animosity in the banking world today because it's so regulated. It looks like, you know, they're all out there to work together. We don't have the issue
We do have that kind of animosity in Congress, though.
Yeah, well, we still have it in the banking world, and this is the point. We have a common currency, which makes it a lot easier. You can't knock each other out by just undermining each other's currency because we're all sharing one. That means you would undermine your own currency. The reality was that was happening back then, too. It was just one step removed. Okay, come forward to 2007 and 2008. And all the banks were buying each other's papers again. Only we weren't calling it currency. We were calling it derivatives and credit default swaps. What is a credit default swap? A credit default is when somebody doesn't pay their bill. They've defaulted on their credit. A swap means that if I have a creditor that doesn't pay me, I can go to the people that bought my that I paid for insurance. I bought a swap from them. I can go to them and they will give me some of the money so I don't lose it all. So they're leaning on each other again. And it was this great idea where if we all have credit default swap insurance, then nobody really loses anything if somebody doesn't pay their bill. Well, when all the people stop paying their bills at once, there's a problem. Lehman Brothers was prior to all the people not paying their bills at once. They were shaky because some people weren't paying their bills. They had deposits at Citigroup and Bank of America and about 14 major banks. Those deposits measured in lots of billions of dollars. And the specific settlement we're talking about is Citigroup. Lehman Brothers had $2.1 billion on deposit in cash at Citigroup. Why is one bank depositing money in another bank? Well, because they were using that account to buy credit default swaps and to sell credit default swaps. So it's easier to have money at the place that you're buying, just like Shanghai. It's easier to have the money in present to make the trade. Well, Lehman Brothers was having some issues paying its payroll because some of its bills weren't being paid. It said, we need to get some of these deposits back. But these deposits had an agreement on them that said, you're going to use these deposits to buy credit default swaps. So when Lehman Brothers went to the other banks and said, I want my money back, all of the banks, there were 14 major banks that did this, seized Lehman Brothers deposits. So Citigroup seized $2.1 billion of Lehman Brothers assets. Nobody knows if that's legal. This is something I think you would find interesting. Nobody knows if that's against the law or not, because there is an agreement that says they were going to buy these default swap trades in the future. And there were some trades that were lined up that actually have a cost. If you break that trade, it's going to cost Citigroup some money. But what about the ones that weren't lined up, that were scheduled but not actually taking place for 2 or 4 years? Well, Citigroup charged as if they had to break those trades and kept all the money. And they weren't the only ones. All the major banks did it to Lehman Brothers. So now there is this big lawsuit between Lehman Brothers, and now they've gone through 13, Citigroup being the 13th bank. They have just Credit Suisse left to sue and finalize. And they've settled 13 times with these big banks. They went through a month of court, and everybody, all the economists, are hoping that they get a court ruling to say whether or not it's legal to seize those assets, because nobody knows. Well, Citigroup finally said, all right, let's stop the court business. I'm going to pay you $1.79 billion and we'll call it quits. So they seized $2.1 billion but gave back $1.79. There's a difference there. Banks still don't like each other. And at this point, it's hidden underneath layers of derivatives. It's so complex that people are going, oh, the banks are in great cooperation, and look, the bankers, they're ruling the world. No, the bankers are constantly at each other's throats. We just don't see it because it's complex enough. There is a piece to this that I find humorous, quite humorous. The deposits that Lehman Brothers had at all these different banks was to purchase and sell insurance in the event that someone wasn't able to pay their debts. So you follow that so far?
I do.
Okay, so we're buying things so that we can protect each other in the event somebody can't pay their debts. Then Lehman Brothers is the one that is trying to pay its debt and can't get the money back because it's locked up in a contract that says it's waiting just in case someone can't pay its debt. It's kind of complex, but if you're geeky enough, that's humorous.
You're geeky enough, so
the whole process to prevent risk is the thing that caused Lehman Brothers to fail. And that's been settled this week. AIG was just declared no longer too big to fail, so it can fail on its own now if it likes, and the government won't get involved. And we've got a caller on 773-1400. Caller, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, enjoy the show. Jeff, welcome back.
Thank you.
Reading in the Wall Street Journal the summary about the S&P going up, and it said that most of the major global economies are still in a stimulus phase. And I know the U.S. went through a couple of rounds of QE, and now the Fed is getting ready to sell off all of their portfolio. I'm wondering if the other global economies pretty much did what the U.S. did. When the U.S. starts selling, the Fed starts selling off their portfolio, is that going to cause a change in thinking about what the other foreign governments are doing? I'll hang up and listen. Thanks.
That's a good question. That is.
It is.
Yeah.
And it's the selling of the portfolio has already begun.
Well, sort of.
It's just the first payments have gone out. It's a relatively small portion.
Right now, the Fed is contemplating not so much selling. Their initial step is to not replace bonds when they mature. And when they don't replace bonds, when they mature, effectively, they're sold. In other words, they're gradually, very slowly shrinking their balance sheet. Now, when they actually, which they plan to do this year, start selling bonds, we're going to be in sort of uncharted water because, very frankly, the Fed has never gone out and bought bonds. I mean, they've always had the ability to do that. They had the ability to do it during the Great Depression, but they didn't do it. And this was kind of an experiment under Ben Bernanke to avoid a depression, to flood the money into the economy to replace the money that Jake was just talking about that was lost as the economy, as those securities that were held by banks suddenly ceased to have value. That's uncharted waters. We haven't been there before. It should have a tendency to increase longer-term interest rates. Longer-term interest rates going up is generally considered a good sign. But then again, low interest. We're just in a whole new universe here.
Here's what happened when the Fed stopped buying bonds on the open market. Japan, China, Germany, and quite a few other foreign governments started buying U.S. treasuries at a higher rate. So they just filled up the demand that was lacking when the Federal Reserve stopped. We have seen about a 1% increase in interest rates in the 10-year treasury over the last 12, 18 months or so. Which means that interest rates have come up,
yeah,
because the Fed has stopped buying. And when they start selling, they're going to come up a little bit more. Other banks are looking at their own balance sheets and looking at their own economies, and they're just at the very beginning of growth. They're not going to start trimming their balance sheets yet. They took a long time to copy the Fed. It took them 8 years to say, hey, that seems to be working and our system seems to be broken. So you can give thanks to Draghi for that and quite a few of the other central bankers at the independent countries.
It's also worth remembering that the talking heads, particularly on Fox, were running horror stories and fear-mongering that we're going to have runaway inflation. And in fact, what, of course, we've had is amazingly low inflation. It continues to be amazingly low. As a matter of fact, one way of looking at prices during the month of October, and there's obviously several ways of looking at it, they actually went down. The lowest measure that the Labor or Commerce Department has for rising prices is 0.1%, and that's how much even the official inflation went up in the month of August. And
there's a good reason for that.
Yeah.
The reason is and this is one that I hear a lot of economists saying, I don't know why this is. But I hear some others that are not so public-minded saying, well, it's pretty simple. The Fed's been raising interest rates. The Fed's been – they're ahead of inflation. We got some inflation at the beginning of the year, at the end of last year. We've got two quarters in a row where we're 3% plus in our GDP growth. But because interest rates were raised and the Fed stopped buying the bonds, we're having – less money moving around, even with a growing economy. They may have overdone it, but they have to keep up they have to keep it up because they're also in the process. Their hands are tied. If we do have a recession, which none of us foresee happening in the near future, but it could happen, and their job is to try to stimulate the economy in that event. If we have a recession and they have to combat deflation, they already have so many bonds on the book that they have a very limited capacity to buy more. The interest rates are already so low that they have a very limited ability to lower them further. So they have to sell some back, hopefully slowly, without disrupting the growth and without knocking us into deflation in the process. But they've got to get some of the tools back for when we do have another recession, because that's not an if. It's not like someday we're going to stop having recessions. We're going to have another one. And their job is to be prepared for it. And right now, they are, putting it lightly, unprepared for a recession. All of their tools are in use, and they have to free them up.
One of the things that's going on right now that is at least a conundrum to us is the very vague, and I want to emphasize, and this is a whole subject matter by itself, the very, 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 very vague 9 pages. When I say 9 pages, the Trump
fluff.
Tax relief. Most one of those pages, for instance, has a single line of 5 words on it. That was released, the tax cut proposal, not so much tax reform as tax cut proposal released by the Trump administration.
The average paragraphs per page, I think, is like 5.
And it is just
small paragraph.
Very, very little information on there. But the point is, the Federal Reserve is saying we're going to start selling bonds, which is a way of taking money out of the economy, because they anticipate that the economy is about to overheat because we have extremely low unemployment. Another subject, by the way, I'd like to talk about at some point. But so the Federal Reserve is working at pulling money out of the economy while Congress and the president have just announced what they want to do is
dump money into the economy,
dump a lot of money to the economy. And the, because all these tax cuts that we're talking about, what happened is the Republicans, the leaders in the Senate, in the House, in the tax and spend area, have agreed that increasing the deficit over the next 10 years by $1.5 trillion by their estimates is a good idea, which is a little bit of a conundrum to me, for because these are the same people who a few years ago in 2011 were willing to shut the government down because of deficit spending, and we now have a deficit that's running $500 billion a year.
Well, they firmly believe by lowering taxes that it's going to increase the profitability of America, and therefore more taxes will come back to them, but well, I can't get that math to work. I've tried, and there are times when lowering taxes definitely raises revenue. This is not one of them. We can measure it very clearly.
Yeah, and we've actually looked at this has been done in the past. For instance, the Bush tax cut, the a whole series of things. And you really, when taxes are really, really high, like we have a 90% tax bracket, like we did under at the beginning of John Kennedy's administration,
right?
Or when we're in a position where taxes are too high and revenue is in tax evasion and tax avoidance is obviously a very high level sport, competing with the NFL. Under those circumstances, lowering taxes will, at least historically, will reduce the disincentive to pay taxes, so more people will pay taxes and we'll have better economic activity and the tax revenue grows. But we're not at that point. We're at a point where, for starters, one of the things they're talking about is increasing jobs. Well, we're at pretty much max employment. There's very few people left looking for work who can't find work. So that's going to be a bit of a problem. What it does, the matter of fact, the tax cut, the economist that I read about it said would definitely be inflationary at this moment in time, which means that the Federal Reserve will need to raise interest rates to slow the economy down while the tax cut is speeding the economy up, but also running the deficit up. And by the way, the tax proposal by the president was given a real quick rating. It's a very vague proposal, obviously. But $1.5 trillion won't even touch that because it's all tax cuts.
Let me kind of get this, because there is a comfort level in the United States. The complexity of the tax code gets in the way of seeing the real picture. The trees get in the way of the forest so quickly. As soon as you start trying to look at the forest, the trees jump right in your face. Let's make this simple. What is the percentage of the GDP that's paid to the government as tax revenue? And right now, that percentage, this is as of 2015, is 18.3% of GDP. That's a big chunk of the GDP. It's almost one-fifth. We're talking about if one-fifth of everything that is made as far as profit goes to the government. The last time it was that high was back in 2001. Do you remember what happened in 2001?
We
cut taxes.
Yeah.
Because we felt like it was too high. The year before that, it was 20%. So we went 4 years in a row in the 19, 20, and 18, top 18% of GDP going in. We're back there now. And we had some low areas back in 2009 and 2010. It was 14% of GDP. But you can go back through history and you see every time we get up close to the 18 mark, 18% of GDP, America as a whole goes, this is too much. And we get tax reform. So 1982, nice little number here. 1982, the year before, we had 19% of GDP. And back when, 84, when the Tax Act was fully in place, we were down to 16. So this is the sort of thing, every time we start creeping up into that higher percentage of GDP, it does slow down the economy. It really is a drag on the economy. Maybe taxes are too high if we look back at history, but we're spending a lot more than we did back then. A lot more.
Yeah, and if you notice, the bill to the tax reform bill is not accompanied by any spending cuts. As a matter of fact, it's accompanied by some spending increases in the current budget proposal.
Right. And I want to throw this out here just in the middle of it, because it sounds like we're trash talking the idea of cutting taxes. I would love it if taxes got cut. Personally, or for my clients, it would be a big boon. And big boon. We would have a lot more money to spend. We would get to do with it what we wanted instead of what the government wanted. The problem is that the government hasn't lowered its obligations. It's raising its obligations. It's saying we're going to pay out more money. That's a problem. We're having the same experiment earlier on the bell curve, but moving along it nicely, that the Greeks just failed at.
You know, and I don't know that there's any way to slow this particular train down. Very frankly, I think that the Republicans who have the majority in the House and the Senate, want to pass a bill, a major change, so they can say we passed a major change so they can get reelected. And I understand that. And I also understand if they come to the public and say, let's cut taxes for the middle class, let's cut taxes for lower income people, let's cut taxes for corporations, let's just cut taxes for everybody. And well, Secretary Mnuchin said it is going to give the average family $1,000 more a year to spend.
You know, there was a political campaign at the turn of the 20th century saying a chicken in every pot for dinner. That was a big deal because most people didn't eat meat every day.
Mm-hmm.
I think the lower the taxes thing is cupcakes and bacon for dinner every night.
You all get lots of candy.
Lots of candy, cupcakes, bacon, as much as you can eat, and
I think
there may be some consequences long term.
I think it may pass because, among other things, one of the reasons the business owners were surveyed across the country and universally they're in favor of it.
Yeah, I'm in favor of it for our business. I'm in favor of it for clients, but not for the country.
I did a very quick and sort of dirty analysis, and it has to be dirty because
we don't have any numbers.
We don't have the vagueness of the proposal is pretty astonishing.
Vague is even not covering it enough.
It's very vague. If we make some assumptions about what congressmen have said and a whole series of things,
yeah, that's dangerous.
For us and our business, we could see a dramatic cut in taxes. On the other hand, there is the threat that, well, if you're just providing services, we're not going to cut your taxes.
You're just providing services.
That's
what
Secretary Mnuchin said. We're going to do it for manufacturers. You know, when you talk about pass-through, 25%.
Yeah, just for manufacturers. It's okay, so think, what is service? Because that's not really well-defined right now. Is software a service?
Yes.
Sometimes. Sometimes it is. Sometimes it isn't. And that's where we've got some complexity nobody's dealt with.
All I've got to say is that this thing going to Congress is about as vague as the Obamacare proposal from the presidency going to Congress and could result in a 900-page tax code that is
more complex than the one we have now.
Nobody understands when it gets passed.
Maybe that we'll still have the current tax code in a zombie form staggering along behind a new, less dead but still not functional tax code.
It really boils down to the tax code. The tax proposals originally was floated out by the House of Representatives, where such things have to start, included the border adjustment tax, which would provide about $1 trillion a year. No.
Over 10 years.
Provide, well, more than a trillion. Basically, the border adjustment tax would probably effectively pay for the reduction in corporate tax rates, but it wouldn't pay for a reduction in everybody else's tax rates.
And what's important here is that who it would have damaged, who would be paying that? And the vast majority of it would be
consumers, yeah.
low-income consumers buying at Walmart or any other place that imports items. They would just pay more for it. So it's a form of tax
that died.
Through what you pay. Yeah,
that died.
It didn't work.
The tax cuts were really popular, but the increase in revenue that would come from raising prices at Walmart was unpopular. And we're really in an awkward position. I would love to see, we need to have the corporate tax rates cut, but we have to also recognize that our individual rates in the United States, individual tax rates, are the lowest that they of any country in the developed world, and I guess probably in the undeveloped world too. I don't know. I haven't.
Not in the developed world, by the way. Ireland.
Individual tax rates.
Yeah, there's a bunch of individual. There's a good I can send.
What
you.
We talk about
Ireland,
is the
Ireland looks pretty good.
Yeah. Well.
So does.
So Ireland has lower taxes, but they
Denmark and Sweden not at all good.
No, and
you're talking 60%.
Germany and the rest of the European Union. Have considerably higher individual tax rates and then lower corporate rates. We could do the same thing, obviously, and continue to balance the budget. They spend money on other things. We spend money on defense, and there's a lot of back and forth on that.
Well, Trump wants to spend money on a really big fence, on defense. It's the wall.
You just –
defense.
Yeah, okay, that's a bad pun.
It was a bad pun.
So the point is that – I can't – one of the things that I have a lot of trouble imagining at this point is the same members of Congress who are deficit hawks agreeing to dramatically increase an already too large deficit.
They're not really deficit hawks. I think they're just –
but they've claimed to be deficit
they're
hawks.
They're spending hawks. But the thing is, they're also low tax hawks. And they get lumped in with a deficit hawk, and they even – claim to be deficit hawks because they say we're not going to raise debt ceilings or whatever. But the reality is that they are pro low tax and pro less spending, but they can't get the less spending done, so they might as well do the low tax. That's going to leave us with bigger deficits.
And by the way, you are listening to the Personal Wealth Coach, and the telephone number to call in here if you'd like to join us, if today is September 30th, where you are, is 254-773-1400. But we also probably ought to play some commercials.
Yes, we should.
Okay.
And, we've got a call.
Well,
do you want to try the call
first? Let's do the call. Forget
all right.
We need stinky commercials.
Who needs commercials? Yeah. All right. Caller,
you're on
the
air with the Personal Wealth Coach. Go ahead.
Yeah, guys, one of the line items in the budget or the tax cut proposal is repatriation of offshore money.
Mm-hmm.
Who's sitting on that? How much is it? And what are they going to do with it once it gets back over here? Are they going to distribute it to this dividends, or are they going to invest it? I'll hang up on this.
Good question again. The numbers aren't clear on this, but there is a long-term permanent repatriation lowering of that tax. And I wouldn't trust any of the numbers that are in this document, but the concept of having a permanent repatriation of assets, so Google, Facebook, all of the major tech companies, all of the manufacturing companies that have manufacturing facilities overseas, so I would say a large portion of the S&P 500 have money elsewhere that they've earned elsewhere that they don't want to bring back to the United States, because as soon as they do, they get taxed again on it. They've already paid taxes to the government that they earned it in the location that they earned it. They're going to get taxed again if they bring it back. Well, if we lower the amount that they pay, they'll want to bring it back because we still are the center of innovation for the world. We still have the brain trust of the world here, and we can lose that if we don't bring the money home. If we start hiring people elsewhere to do our thinking for us, eventually we're not going to think very much back here. So there is a tremendous benefit, and one of the biggest boons to this tax change would be those companies spending the money here, doing things to innovate and new technology research, that sort of thing here.
Actually, reading the proposal isn't quite as simple as the verbal proposals we've heard.
Right.
The proposal says, hey, we're going to tax overseas earnings of American companies, where at least 10% of the company is owned by American corporation, as if they had been earned in the United States, maybe at a different rate. But it transfers what's called, in the exact words are, it transfers our existing offshoring model to an American model. It ends the perverse incentive to keep foreign profits offshore by exempting them when they are repatriated to the United States. Cool. But it says, in addition to transition to this system, the framework treats foreign earnings that have accumulated overseas under the old system as repatriated. In other words, basically,
you don't have to pay anything.
No. What it's saying is, if a corporation is holding assets overseas in liquid position or even fairly liquid position,
even if you don't bring it back,
we're going to hit those corporations with a tax on their overseas earnings that they're holding overseas, whether they bring them back or not.
That's correct.
And frankly, that has all the probabilities of success as a lead balloon. The issue is, it would be a massive tax on U.S. corporations. Now, it says we'll give them the opportunity to pay this off over an extended period.
Right.
Put a huge liability, currently illegal under the law. Basically, we're going to take all the overseas earnings that corporations have had in the past, and we're going to tax them as if they were earned in the United States.
Now. Only you can pay it over several years. And this is the last piece of this is that foreign earnings held in illiquid assets, that means not cash,
will give you a lower rate on that.
Will be a lower tax, which means you still owe taxes on something that cannot be liquidated quickly.
Basically, we're going to tax American corporations on everything they hold overseas as if it were in the United States.
But at a slightly lower rate.
But some of it will be at a slightly lower rate, particularly the stuff that you can't sell.
So there's some problems in there, as you can hear.
That will go over
like a lead balloon.
That would be horrific for American companies.
And this is important. All of those big companies that I just mentioned, a few years ago, were sitting on cash, and they still talk about it as if it is sitting on cash. But if you go to Google and look at their finances, financial books, if you go to Facebook or Apple or any of the ones that have the big chunks of money overseas, you'll see they're now held as long-term assets, illiquid assets. There's only a small amount of money because they don't want to just have it sitting there in Europe with negative interest rates. They've purchased something with it. What they've purchased, we don't know. But just imagine that there is a large amount of money, very large amount of money over there that's invested locally, semi-illiquid, and those companies are going to be taxed on. There's some problems with that.
And let me explain something here that I think is really important to understand. And that is that the money that is held overseas by U.S. corporations is money from profits they made selling stuff overseas. It was never in the United States.
Right. It was manufactured there and sold there in many cases.
It'd be convenient to come back and be able to reinvest that in the United States, but taxes make that prohibitive to penalize those companies that have reinvested and built plants and done things because they, with the money, let's say they sold computers in Germany and they built a computer plant in Germany, and then to tax them on that computer plant that's in Germany that's never been in the United States.
I'll tell you the result.
A little strange, to say the least.
That portion of the law will cause headquarters of American companies to move overseas.
Yeah.
There are other portions of this law that may make it more lucrative to have your headquarters here, but this one, anybody that has already got a lot of money overseas, it's going to make them want to keep it there.
And
not only keep it there, but move their headquarters there.
The ability of this tax proposal to pay for itself is largely predicated on the idea that we can tax, even if there's only 10% ownership, we can tax American corporations for everything they own and have purchased overseas ever, as long as time exists, and they have to pay taxes on it even if they don't have the money to pay it with.
We reference this as vague, and the reality is that it doesn't look like a lot of the bureaucrat types, what they would say in Britain, the boffins, haven't really looked at this summary. This looks like it was created purely politically, and not a lot of math was done on certain parts of it. So there are real issues there. We do have to play some commercials. We'll come back and talk about the real need for reform. We need to get behind some reform because the complexity is too big, but we've got to play some commercials first. So we'll be back on the other side.
And we're back with a little more of the first personal wealth coach this hour and a lot more next hour, but the telephone number remains 254-773-1400.
This is the personal wealth coach, and I wanted to end that up. I am happy that we have something out there to begin the negotiation mm-hmm. with as far as tax reform goes. And when I said I wouldn't pay too close an attention to the numbers that are listed in there or even
the words.
All this is the beginning. See the stuff is going to fly as this gets negotiated, and it may be really simple or it may be really complex. The beginning is extremely vague
and
not very good looking at the beginning.
I really don't think that the president's tax proposal has a chance in the world of making it through Congress. If it did make it through Congress,
in its current
state.
Pretty
well determined something's going to happen.
And if you'd like to contact us off the air, we do give personalized advice. The phone number is 1-800-914-7526 for voicemail, or Jeff or Jake at tpwc.com.
Truth. It's not just a word on your Fox News station. News Radio 1400 KTEM AM. Temple, Belton, Killeen, Fort Hood.